Do you want to talk about how you're feeling right now?
Oh, so many questions. What does this mean? What do I do?
Go on! Tell them what you think!
I liked it.
I think your calculations may have been off.
I think it's all right.
I just have a lot of feelings.
This pleases me.
These are perfectly normal feelings.
Do you even know what you sound like when you talk like that?
Now, shall we begin?
All right, guys, and welcome back to the Real Feels Podcast. This is Drew here.
And this is Nathan.
Hey, Nathan.
Hey, everybody.
Hey, guys, welcome to the Real Feels Podcast. We are here to talk about movies every other Wednesday and bring it to you and just basically talk about what makes these movies work.
On if a silver platter or whatever. We serve it up nice and hot.
Nice and hot. And, you know, it really it is for your tastes as well as ours. But then again, and I think we're all going to walk away pretty satisfied.
This taste, I don't know, Drew. I think this taste is going to leave them like a little bit wanting to ask the waiter if they ordered the wrong thing because they just kind of feel a little bit saddened by it. Maybe it's because of the music that the band's playing, the live music at there. This movie is hard to swallow on all ends. But it's a good movie.
It's very deep. It's very emotional. But you know what? It is a hard-hitting story that is, again, 100% true. It's based on a biography by Jane Wilde. And ladies and gentlemen, tonight we're going to be talking about 2014's The Theory of Everything.
Roll that promo, baby.
Let's do it.
You see how the men's shirts glow more than the women's dresses?
Yes.
Do you know why?
Why?
Tide.
The washing powder.
The fluorescence in the washing powder is caught by the UV light.
Why do you know that?
The universe is expanding. If you reverse time, then the universe is getting smaller.
All right.
What if I reverse the process all the way back to see what happened at the beginning of time itself?
Wind back the clock.
Wind back the clock. Until you get
the universe born from a black hole exploding.
It's called motor neuron disease. Life expectancy is 2 years.
The brain. What about the brain?
The brain isn't affected. Your thoughts won't change. It's just no one will know what they are.
I could walk out, but I won't.
If you don't get up, I won't come back here again. Ever.
I wish someone would take my place. Can't face
this
heaven.
This is going to be a very heavy defeat.
You know what you'll think? That I don't look like a terribly strong person, but I love him. He loves me. We're going to fight this illness together. Good luck.
Your black hole theory is brilliant.
To the esteemed Dr. Stephen Hawking.
He will never speak again.
Yes, he will.
My name is Stephen Hawking.
It's American.
Is that a problem?
One never knows from where the next great leap forward is going to come.
There should be no boundary to human endeavor. However bad life may seem, while there is life, there is hope.
And that wasn't a promo, Drew. That was a trailer. But you rolled it anyways. You knew what I was saying.
I did roll it anyways. You know what, guys? This is the story of Stephen Hawking, the late Stephen Hawking, who just passed away. I mean, little over a month ago. No, not even a month. Not even a month ago. He passed away on March 14th, which was Pi Day.
How? It wasn't Einstein's birthday? Yeah.
So he was born on, what was it, the 300th anniversary of Galileo's birthday, and it was he died on the 130, no, man, I can't, I can't remember. He did die on something that was related to Einstein's birthday.
Get your obscure facts correct, Drew. Come on. This is you have one job. No, I'm just kidding. You're my go-to obscure facts man.
Stephen Hawking was born on the 300th anniversary of Galileo's death and died on their... See, I had it right.
There it is.
I just was confused. And died on the 139th anniversary of Einstein's birth.
Okay.
So, yeah. I mean, one of the greatest minds of our entire generation. One that had changed the entire, like, facet of how physics in our universe, you know, be it may... is conceived, and the whole concept of black holes and where life came from. I mean, this is literally, you know, it all started with a Big Bang, to quote a very
popular show,
television show. It's a fantastic show.
It is good. And I just, you know, as you were talking about the big man himself, he's no longer going to be able to do cameos for them, because he was always a fun little... You know, oh, Stephen Hawking is in the Big Bang. I don't know.
You know what? I remember one of my favorite things is when, like, Sheldon was, he was working with Stephen Hawking on the show, and he had sent him a paper, and Stephen Hawking found, like, some kind of typo, and Sheldon freaked out because he's like, oh my gosh, there's a typo. There's a typo, and Stephen Hawking found it. I sent a typo to Stephen Hawking, and he, like, fainted.
Oh, Sheldon.
Oh, Sheldon. But, you know, guys, this is a it's a fantastic story based on the autobiography of Jane Wilde, who was Stephen Hawking's first wife. And this book basically chronicles their life together, their struggles together, their, you know, sense of love that they had in their marriage and even afterwards, and, you know, the birth of their three children. And it was not only after the book was published, when the screenwriter came across the novel, and it actually took him about 10 years to convince Jane Wilde to get the rights and, you know, make this movie, make it happen. And with the film coming to be, you have director James Marsh, who is very famously known for the documentary film Man on a Wire. And who else we have? We have Eddie Redmayne portraying Stephen Hawking, which... hands down,
bam.
He did. It's almost as if you forget that you are watching Eddie Redmayne portray Stephen Hawking, and that you're not watching Stephen Hawking himself.
Do you think that Eddie is going to be looked upon in the coming, I'd say, like, maybe 10, 20 years added on to this, as the what's his name? Daniel Day-Lewis, that kind of generational standout, just every movie he makes, it's just swings for the fences, and most, if not all of them, land over in a different stadium, like they just go out of the park?
You know, Eddie Redmayne is actually making, like, a very, very big name for himself with not only, of course, The Theory of Everything in 2014, but you also have him in the Wizarding World of Harry Potter for the Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. And he did a fantastic job with that movie last year. They have a brand new one coming out next, in November? They have Fantastic Beasts and the Crimes of Grindelwald. I think Eddie Redmayne, when he does some work, I mean, he really delves into it. He actually...
What do you mean when he does some work? He was in Les Mis. He was in The Danish Girl.
He was in Les Mis as, you know, Maurice. He puts himself into it. He actually strives to try and get everything, like, down to a T. I mean, specifically for this movie in its own, heck, he took up lessons for professional dance on how to control his body to develop the sense that we as an audience are going to believe that he is having these physical limitations with how he's going to lift or drag his leg, how his hands are going to move when trying to, like, you know, let alone, like, move his chair or even, like, pull himself up some stairs. it's fascinating what he actually had to go through.
Every movement he makes, he just sells it. Like, he makes it just believable. Nothing kind of feels wonky. Like oh, that wouldn't happen. Like, it's everything like, oh my gosh. In fact, it makes you say, oh my gosh, this is happening. You feel every kind of movement he makes, you're like, oh god, he's breaking down. Like, it's happening. It's happening. Eddie has been, like I said, this is what I mean, like, by, like, swing for the fences, but, like, sometimes maybe didn't, like, always go over. Because, I don't know, did you ever watch Jupiter Ascending?
Okay, here's the thing.
This is the one, folks, this is the one time we're going to laugh this whole podcast, so you just suck it up and enjoy it.
All right, listen, just listen to me. Okay, Jupiter Ascending is not a fantastic movie.
Oh, no?
Shocking. I think that it is a fun movie to watch. I don't think that Eddie Redmayne's character is, like, glorious in it. However, I think his portrayal of, you know, to kind of, like, parody a song, his careless whispers throughout the entirety of the film, his soft-spoken verbiage is, gosh, it's so fascinating to try
and
listen
to. It's so good. And he committed to that part, too. Like, he was like, I'm going to make this, like, monumental, remembered villain that is going to top Kilgrave.
Right.
It's going to top the Joker. It's going to top every villain that you could possibly think of. Here we go. I'm giving it my all. And that's why I mean, like, Daniel Day-Lewis status, where he just, like, goes the distance with everything he kind of puts into the character, and yeah, Jupiter Ascending, everyone.
it's a fun movie. It's definitely not great.
Get really drunk and then watch it.
Get really drunk and watch it. And as my friends over at the More Gooder Than podcast, they talk about the space skates or the space rollerblades. The thing that the space dog character that where he says, like, I have more in common with a dog, and she's like, I love dogs.
And yeah, Channing Tatum, maybe not the it's not the worst part of the film. We are talking about a totally different film though, folks.
About a totally different film, but the same actor.
And we reel it back.
But, you know,
to Felicity Jones.
Oh yeah, Felicity Jones. She portrayed Jane Wilde so well. And even Jane Wilde was caught in an interview where she had to, like, take a moment and pause when she was asked, like, how did you feel about her portrayal of you? And she said, I found myself reliving these moments and just going, oh my gosh, she has my voice, she has my mannerisms, she has the emotions that, like, I felt at those times. So I mean, I believe that she was very impressed with it. I'm almost shocked that she did not win an Academy Award for it, unlike Eddie Redmayne, who stole leading actor away from Benedict Cumberbatch and Michael Keaton during that year.
Was for Birdman and
that was
Imagination?
For Birdman and The Imitation Game.
Imitation Game, yeah.
Yeah.
Man, talk about...
Steve Carell was even up for an Academy Award during that year.
Oh, okay.
I can't remember what it was for, though. But you know what? Honestly, this is kind of the talk that is about this film in a lot of reviews and on a lot of, like, message boards, that at the time when this movie came out, it just had this overwhelming stink, and stink almost in a good and bad way, of Oscar bait. This biopic performance of someone who not only is so monumental in the real world, but then to show, like, the dramatic sense of his life and his marriage and the struggle therein. So it just screamed, like, Best Picture, leading male actor. It was already there.
It wouldn't have hurt that the camera footage, like, the way they shot a lot of scenes, you know, really lend themselves to, hey, we are swinging for the fence. We all want, you know, some big awards for this, but a lot of callbacks, I feel like, to A Beautiful Mind.
Oh, and yeah, very, very much so.
And just that, like, hey, they killed it with, you know, Russell Crowe and that movie. I mean, they did so good with that. Jennifer Connelly, like, you have this leading woman stepping up and just still kind of not getting the recognition because you are following the performance of, I mean, absolute greatness. Both of Russell Crowe and Eddie just throw down really solid performances. And how do you follow that? How do you step up beyond that?
It's the idea of, again, like, do you take away from the fact that it is such a true story, obviously, because it's based off of Jane Wilder's biography. Do you take away from the fact that stuff is so real, stuff is so heart-wrenching, it almost screams like it's going to be an insult if it's either not nominated or if it doesn't win something?
Yeah, you didn't give My Life an award? Like, this is my, you know, who are you to tell me that it's not? No, it's not what we're saying, but yeah. I hear you. I hear what the critics are saying.
Yeah. But, you know, speaking of, like, the way that it was filmed, you know, the way that the cinematography is done, it's very on point with not only the emotions that the characters are definitely portraying. You actually have brilliant camera angles that are being used in various scenes of the film, and the lighting of the movie itself actually is coinciding with the emotions that the characters are supposed to be, you know, exhibiting, as well as the music. And of course, music is going to embody the different moods that are being, you know, seen in the movies and every one of the scenes that are going to be portrayed. You have also these hard-hitting moments of pure silence where a dramatic pause is never uncomfortable in this movie. It seems so, like, just, it's poignant.
When you wait for the punchline, or not even so much the punchline, but, like, the payoff, and you're not disappointed with it. Like, every time that there is that silence and you kind of, why is there silence? Like, when he's writing, you know, on his computer and you're like, what is he writing? What is he? Oh, this is it? Oh! You know, it's those kind of feelings that it's not this waiting. Oh. Well, yeah, that could have made my cut it out, you know?
There's no real letdown.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's no dramatic letdown in which anything that is actually being, you know, exhibited. I mean, even the scene where his best friend comes back after, you know, Stephen has been diagnosed with ALS, and he is sitting in his room, and the friend comes back and he says, ah, and today on National, like, Geographic World, we see the young Cambridge physicist in his natural, you know, beautiful plumage, and it's his nest, and he's been waiting. And he's trying to make a joke with his friend, and he doesn't realize the situation that he's in. But it's these long dramatic pauses where he finally answers him, and he says, I'm sick. And the son's like, okay. He's like, I have a disease. He's like, is it venereal? And he's trying to be funny, but
Well, to his credit, though, because Hawkins doesn't really, like just come out and say, hey, man, like,
just come out and say it. And again, it's that dramatic kind of, like, staging of making him wait. And definitely you feel, and you can understand later from probably, like, looking back at it, that this is him trying to even cope and, you know, comprehend everything that has just been laid out on him, where he actually has to, like, say the words. He says, I've been given 2 years to live. And his friend's like, I'm sorry, what? And he says, yeah, it does sound weird to say it out loud.
Yeah. Many of the rough lines that come. This whole movie, like, I think I even texted you right afterwards. I was like, this whole movie summed up in one word, difficult. Like,
right.
Everything about this, every moment, every scene is just, it's like steak that's just, you gotta chew it and chew it. It's good, but oh my gosh, it's work, and you gotta kind of figure out how you're going to swallow it, because even in your mouth, you're like, I need to like take my time. I need to really see what each part of this is. And it's heavy. Oh man.
Ugh. Yeah. But I mean, you do have the lightheartedness that actually comes with the film. I mean, even in the beginning, you have Stephen Hawking in his prime. He's racing bikes with his friends over to one of the dorm rooms where there's a party going on. And that's where he actually meets Felicity Jones, you know, Jane Wilde's, you know, character coming in. And there they kind of like fall in love. And you have this ominous blue lighting that is filling the entire room while people are dancing around. And, you know, Jane enters in and her friend's like, oh, scientists, this is not going to be a good party. And her and Steven kind of make eye contact, and they have this awkward, like, geeky, kind of like, you know, perks of being a wallflower kind of, like, meeting. And he just, like, walks him. He's all like, science. She's like, arts. English? Oh, Spanish. French. Oh, you? Oh, I'm a cosmologist. And she's like, what is a cosmologist? And he just kind of looks at her and says, it's like an intellectual atheist. And so you have these banter of words back and forth, and you can definitely see that, again, ironically enough, for the fact that, like, you actually have a scientist there is definitely some chemistry.
Oh yeah, some heat, some sparks,
right?
And honestly, so we need to just, I guess, roll out, I mean, for me, for my cut it out, it would be the bike scene.
What were you thinking?
Well, you got me. By all accounts, it doesn't make sense,
and you've got to cut it out.
Oh, the bike scene in the beginning?
I mean, like, I can't really cut out much else. Like, just trim up the little da 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 da. Like, just cut out them riding their bikes. Just have them kind of show up to the party, and then, I don't know. There's just not much to cut out of this film. Because then you cut out something major.
Right. It's so hard to try and think of anything to cut out that is so real.
Yeah. And I'm sure the bike scene was real. I'm sure that happened. But guess what?
But if just you can cut out anything, that's not necessarily going to be detrimental to the story.
Exactly.
You know, honestly, like, if I'm going to grab anything that's going to be cutting it out, it's going to be that, you know what? It's kind of funny. You have a beginning. I have an end. Towards the end of the movie, when he is being honored by the Queen of England and being knighted.
Okay.
It's not the slow, dramatic, and I use the word loosely, walk up to the chamber before they enter into the room with the queen. It's more the fact that, like, they have this, like, slow motion of him going into the room with the queen, and it just takes up, like, 20 to 30 seconds of awkwardness, and then it transitions outside, and the two of them watching their children play in the garden of, like, Buckingham Palace, that's not a problem for me. It's like this weird conversation, but then again, I think it's almost a necessary weird, but it's not something that I needed for the film.
Yeah, and
The ending line is great. That's perfect. But it's her saying, like, thank you for this. Thank you for inviting me. You know, you can always decline the knighthood. Like, I don't need this scene. I need them rekindling the connection. But then again, that could have also been brought on by the awkward conversation that happened there.
Maybe, but I don't know. I mean, I know exactly what you mean, though. It's kind of we're really going to, like, focus on this at all to end the movie? Meh.
Right. It's interesting enough, after that party that they went to and they started, like... Excuse me. Sorry.
Another cut it out scene. No, I'm just kidding.
So after the party, and they met there, and they kind of, she passed him her number, and, you know, they eventually meet up again at the pub. Inadvertently, they meet up. She's already there. He's already there with his friends, and they just kind of, like, meet up, and he even asks her, like, what's the probability? And she says, incredibly low, really. But it's the steady, upbeat of if you're noticing as an audience member how many instances there are leading up to the point where he is finally diagnosed with ALS. And I counted 6 individual events where you could slightly notice when he is actually showing signs of, you know, the motor neuron disease taking effect slowly and surely. And it's like tiny little things. Like, you probably wouldn't even have noticed the fact that, you know, he spilled his cup of tea in his dorm room, and you're like, oh, he's just waking up and he's clumsy, you know, that's probably nothing. But then he goes on and he has a problem picking up a pen.
Which is a weird callback at the end.
Right.
When he's
at that one moment.
And he just has that kind of feeling of like, I wish I could just get up.
I wish I could just get up and get it. Yeah, that scene. Eddie Redmayne is actually he gave an interview where he said that scene scared him and kept him up at night because he wanted to show it so perfect that
he did good.
It just kind of, I mean, like, I appreciate the fear as a professional to say, like, this should be done right.
And I think it was done right. It wasn't just like where he just like stood up and like
going to get up nonchalantly, walk over and say, madam, your pen. No,
in a weird way, he like Benjamin Buttons it, and like part of him gets better and then another part of him.
It took the moment to show like his feet straightening out, him standing up, and then like even looking at himself, you know, taking those steps, bending down, picking up the pen. Something as simple, not like running a mile, not, I mean, as horrible as it can sound, like
running
not,
with his kids, or
I was going to say like getting up and hugging and picking up his children, or even dancing with his wife again. It's something as simple as something that we could totally take for granted as, oh my gosh, this lady's pen fell, I have to go pick it up. So, I mean, it's stuff like that where, what he even, okay. So speaking of dancing, when he went to the ball, he suddenly tripped while he was carrying his little glass of champagne. That was the third sign. When he was at the train station and they were going to listen to the guy give the speech about black holes, that he tripped at the train station. That was 4. When he was in the room developing the math after that speech, his hands were having tremors, and you could see the writing on the chalkboard is very, it's getting slightly sloppy.
right before he like looks down at his hand and like, you know, is kind of upset with himself. I thought for a second, I'm like, oh man, he's got like my handwriting. Good job, bud. Like, and wait, you're in college? No, I'm just kidding.
And then leaving from that same room where the guy said, develop the math. And he kind of like had that moment of like, oh my gosh, this is good. This is good. I'm making progress. And, you know, leaving and walking back, he trips and falls, and that's where I think he actually did that fall in real life. Like, that does not look staged in any way, but when he fell and hit the concrete at Cambridge, like, his head hit, and then it bounced up, and it hit back down again. Breaks the glasses. He's got a black eye from the fall. Like, that was a hard fall to watch. Like, and that hurt.
It's what starts it all. It's what, you know, it gets him into the doctor to get him tested, and on the path he goes. Yeah. Which,
oh man, I wrote down in my notes, I wrote getting spinal tap. Oh my God, ouch.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't care how many times I've seen a medical show or they have to do something, but if I ever watch a spinal tap, like, that just, oh, I cannot imagine the pain.
That you gotta just lay there still.
Right, that he's gotta go through to get that done. And actually, you know what? Getting that spinal tap and talking to the doctor, it's one of those scenes where, talking about the cinematography, it's so key to how he is taking everything in. It's showing the fact that the wide angle zoom is basically like enclosing his face, so it gives like a sense of being trapped. But also, when it goes from his perspective looking at the doctor, it's done with a wide-angle lens. And so the doctor's face looks stretched out and the background is blurry. So it almost looks like this is something that is so unreal. So like, you're almost in the mind of Stephen Hawking trying to take everything in. And it's just it is a standing ovation and a hearty, hearty clap to the cinematographer for doing such a good job.
What's funny though is this scene right here, for me, I felt was like, whereas, yes, it's very good. In a weird little way for me, maybe a little bit tropey, like kind of like when someone's drunk in a party and it's like, what's going on, man? You know, and you're like, no,
I get you.
But I understood it,
it's not being all like topsy turvy. It's not wonky. It's
true.
It's more like that out of body experience. Like this can't be real. This can't be real.
Time is slowing down. Yeah.
And I mean, even with a doctor, he just like he tells him the news. It's not that he completely has like no care for Stephen Hawking. It's just that he's not a friend. He's not a family member. He feels bad that he has to give bad news, but he has to get bad news all the time. And so he ends up getting up and walking away. And then you get this long view of the hallway and Stephen is just sitting there and he truly like is alone finally where he could try and comprehend everything, where he tells him 2 years. 2 years is the given life expectancy for anyone with ALS. And I mean, even to today, like not even back then, but like just even to today, still the life expectancy, the average life expectancy for anyone diagnosed with ALS is like 2 to 5 years.
That's rough.
And it is. And that's the average life expectancy. However, there are cases, much like Stephen Hawking, where people do live with ALS for far beyond that. I mean, just his marriage with Jane Wilde was 30 years. So,
man.
I mean, obviously, he definitely beat the odds, hands down.
Oh, yeah. But when Jane tells him, like, when, you know, when he finally, like, lets her know, like, hey, you gotta go, like, you don't want this, I'm dying.
That was such a harsh.
And she basically says, like, yeah, you're gonna get up and you're gonna play a game with me, or I will leave.
That was a brutal scene, because then he gets up and he goes out. She's like, play a game of croquet right now. And he just gets up, you know, goes outside, takes the croquet mallet, takes the croquet balls and just starts whacking them. And then sets it up and just does it faster.
Weird part. Like it at first kind of seemed really romantic, like, oh, wow. Like, kind of Buzz Lightyear going, no, I can't fly. Like, look at me. And then he gets out and he's almost like, you see, I'm dying. Like, oh. Right.
And you can see it on her face. She is just breaking in heartache.
The
cringe.
She's
watching him. Like, two things are happening. She's watching how much he is struggling to move around and it's just tearing her apart. But then you also see how much he is showing such resentment and anger, and not exactly directly at her, but at the situation at hand, where like all he wants to do is to just kind of wallow in self-pity, which it's understandable. You were just told like you have 2 years to live. I mean, come on, like he has an excuse to grieve, but she wants to have him understand that she is there for him. I mean, before she even asked him to go play croquet, she said, like, what are you doing? And he said something like, trying to work out the mathematical probability of happiness. You know, there's some kind of variable. Yeah. I'm pretty sure it's zero, which means that there is zero probability of happiness. And it's just, it's a heart-wrenching scene, which actually, it actually brings it up to one of my favorite lines in the entire film.
You wanna get to it?
You know what? I think we can get to a little. You can say that again.
Jump into it.
Oh my goodness! That's the most badass thing I've ever heard.
Do you understand the words that are coming out of my mouth?
That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
You can say that again.
So with you can say that again, it's a segment of the show where we definitely want to talk about our favorite lines of the film, but also the lines that are just bad. But that doesn't mean they're terribly, terribly bad. It just means they're so bad that we remember them. So with my favorite line of the film, it's immediately after this horrid croquet game where he's essentially throwing a fit, but an understandable fit. And she comes into the room or his dorm room after he goes in there and, you know, throws his chess set to the ground. And he's so, so visibly angry. And she talks him down and he tries to tell her, like, you need to go. It's going to be 2 years. I need to work. I'm going to die. It's going to ruin everything. And she tells him that she loves him. But it's at the moment where she proves to him that she loves him and basically changes everything about him, where she looks up in his eyes and she just tells him, "Your glasses are always dirty."
Leave me now.
Are you going to talk about this or not?
Excuse me, just go.
Is that what you want?
Yes, it is what I want, so please, if you care about me at all, then please just go.
I can't.
I have 2 years to live. I need to work.
I love you.
You've left her. That's a false conclusion.
I want us to be together for as long as we've got, and if that's not very long, well, then that's just how it is. It'll have to do.
You don't know what's coming. It'll affect everything.
Your glasses are always dirty. There. That's better, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, it is.
And it's that moment where she takes his glasses and cleans them to show him that, I tell you that I love you. I tell you that I want to be with you and that I want to help you. I'm going to start now. And your glasses are dirty and I'm going to clean them. And that's just such a heartfelt moment for me. It shows that she is there for thick and thin. She wants to help him with everything that is important to him, even something as minuscule as cleaning his glasses.
And it's something, yeah, just like you said, it's very sweet. And it's like, hey,
right,
simple, but you need to do this. And you almost are too in your own head about everything else that you're going to forget the thing right in front of you that blurs your whole view on life. Which, we'll give it to her, Jane, like, you punched your time clock, you know? You went the distance, and just some of those moments where she is just ready to give up and just ready to be like, how long did the doctor say you're going to be alive for? Like, come on, like, man, it's, this is hard.
It's definitely evident that this was more of a relationship of give rather than take. And it's all on Jane. I mean, not that Steven didn't suffer or not that Steven didn't put in any kind of effort, but it is so apparent, at least from this perspective, again, it's her biography, that she was the one who was sacrificing, like, her goals, her aspirations, because remember, she wanted that master's in, like, medieval Spanish poetry. There's the scenes where she's clearly in the other room trying to study or, like, you know, mark up a thesis or write a paper or something, and Steven's in the living room riding around in the motorized wheelchair with the kids and knocking over the table. And you can see in her eyes of, like, well, he's parenting.
Yeah.
But now I have to clean that up.
That's great. Thanks for being a great dad. No, but, and that's the thing is, like, you trade one bit for another where, yeah, you have to clean up, but this is kind of all that he can do. And, you know, and he's just having fun with his kids. So in the moment, she's pissed, obviously, because she just spent all day probably cleaning and taking care of the kids, and now she has to do some more. But if she steps back and kind of realizes it, as the audience, as we do it, like, look, he's spending time with them, and he is trying to be the best that he can. So, yeah, yeah.
And it's not that it's, like, a bad depiction of the marriage at all. I think it's actually, I mean... To say it in probably the worst, like, summation of it, it is a very safe movie. It's a story that you are going to have one perspective. It's not going to have a contrary perspective to it, especially from Steven's, you know, viewpoint. It's going to be all from Jane. So you don't get, like, Steven's understanding or remembering of certain events. He definitely said that when going out and watching the movie, which it's recorded that he did cry at the film, but also watching it film, he is quoted as saying that it's remarkable how close they got it. But again, it's weird. It's interesting. Yeah, it's very interesting where, so, you know, married for 30 years. They eventually did have, like, the marriage kind of not necessarily fall apart about midway, but it was more to the point where she did end up meeting Jonathan, the guy from the church. And Stephen Hawking has actually been quoted as saying that he gave permission to Jane that she could go off and essentially have this like acceptable affair, or, you know, they would open up their marriage slightly. Stephen would agree to it as long as he was the one that she loved. Because I think that he even knew that there were limitations to himself. There were, but more importantly, I think he wanted her to be happy.
Yeah.
It's not that the love had completely gone. I think that he understood that she had been through so much and that she needed some care. And that was something that he, I guess, didn't necessarily could do at that point.
Well, and Brooke should know this, my fiance. If Charlie Cox, Mr. Matt Murdock, you know, is ever helping us out and I'm, you know, not physically 100%, she has my full blessing to shack up with Charlie Cox. That guy is awesome. I love
shack up with Daredevil. It's okay.
that's okay. But yeah, that's
Brooke, you heard it here now. It is
there's your hall pass.
There's your hall pass.
Right there. That one guy. My mom's gonna hear this and be like, oh, he was on Downton Abbey. I loved him. Yeah. Anyways.
Your mom's a good lady.
She's awesome.
Okay, so what do you got for your favorite line?
My favorite line is kind of that call towards the end where they're looking at their kids, and just the way he says, look what we made.
What are you writing?
Look what we made.
I feel like that's kind of the best summary of the film, is that like everything, all the pain and heartache that you go through as a parent, it's all for really your kids. And like just the fact that like look what we built, not, you know, my reputation, not my all my world renownedness, not your thesis, not your house cleaning, but like these three kids that we raised and are ours. Look, this is what we made. And it's just a great moment.
All right.
Really good. Yeah. But lines to cut it out. What would you
the worst line?
The only one that I kind of felt like I was like mad at him is when he says like, oh, no doctors, which is so ironic because I'm very much like that. I don't want to go to the doctor.
It's such the pride.
It is. It's so deep down inside where you know something's wrong with you and you're like, no, I'm good. Don't worry about me. But not in like a self-pity way, but like, no, I don't really want to be broken.
Right. And even like the moment, like, okay, so it's the drive home after that whole instance where he said no doctors. And he even, what does he say to Jane? He says, you know, we're a perfectly normal family. And she's like, no. No, we're not.
Yeah. Nope.
We are not normal. And, oh gosh. Another time. Oh man. What's another one where he's just like, he's so prideful. Oh, when he's in the wheelchair for the first time, she brings the wheelchair in and he sits down and he says, this is only temporary. And she's like, of course it is.
Which, do you think that he meant this is only temporary as in, hey, don't worry, like, I only got 2 years, like, this is, yeah, technically this is really temporary.
I don't think he meant it like, hey, don't worry, I'm not going to be in this wheelchair long, like, I'm going to
die. Oh, you think
soon.
That he was like, I'm going to walk again?
That he's having. I think he was definitely trying to, like, keep up the, like, optimistic to a fault kind of thing where it's always, like, the rose-colored glasses, like, you always try to put the best spin on every situation. Like, even when he tells Jane that Elaine, his new, like, live-in nurse, the one that he eventually falls in love with and marries to be his second wife later on in his life, he tells her, he says, oh, I've asked Elaine to go with me to America to get this award. He says, she'll take care of me. And Jane's like, will she? And he says, yes. And he tells her, like, everything will be okay, is what he always says. Like, everything will be okay.
They're there.
And gosh, that's one of those moments where I hate the line where he says everything is okay, because, again, it's so delightfully optimistic to a fault. And I understand it, because I'm one of those guys. I'm always going to be optimistic to a fault, even though if I know something is wrong, like, I'm going to try and either, and I hate it, because I always, gosh, I get so angry at my dad when he does this sometimes. He'll crack a joke when it's a serious situation, and he tries to lighten the mood. And I've noticed, like, over the years that I do this, or I will be so optimistic in certain situations where I know it should be serious, but I'm going to be so confident in the fact that, like, no, it's going to be okay. It's everything's going to work out just fine. You know, everything's going to be all right. You got to be more positive. And it's at that point where he says, you know, everything's going to be okay. How many years? And she said, you've had so many. And that's when she starts crying, and she just kind of, like, gets down next to him, and she tells him, like, I have loved you.
Yeah. Oh. And like, I did my best. Like, oh, come on.
Right.
It's rough.
It's so heartbreaking to, like, get the lines, because, like, the whole, you know, everything will be okay. And she has to tell him, like, no, like, it's not okay. And everything's not been okay. And she's, you know, just to tell him, like, I did my best to love you. To even, like, hear the lines, like, I did my best. Like, I tried.
And is that the first time that you see him cry in the film?
It is.
Like, cry almost over the situation? Okay. Because other times he gets upset. You know what it is?
It's the first time that I think you actually see, like, a real tear out of his face. Because the other moment that, for me, probably, like, one of the hardest moments in this entire film for me is to watch him leave the dinner table when he's having such frustrations trying to, like, pick up the spoon and feed himself, and he's watching his wife and all of his friends just, you know, casually, like, pick up a fork, eat some salad, pour themselves the bread. A glass of wine. Yeah. Like, it's so, I think, flustering to him that he leaves the room, and he tries to make himself go up the stairs, where early on in the film, when he went to go, like, present his thesis, I believe, that was later on, but one of the scenes, he's making his way down the stairs, and he's, like, you know, like, butt scooting down each step, and she has to help pull him up. And so he is trying to go up these stairs by himself, like, cradling his arms in between the banisters and, like, the railing, and, like, pulling himself up, like, struggling. Like, you can see the struggle and the strain and how out of breath he is. And it's like you feel his frustration to try and do something again. Just like picking up the pen, something that we probably wouldn't even think about, to go up, like, a simple set of stairs, like 10 stairs, like 10 steps.
But dude, these are the big parts of the film that I was like,
the moment he looks up, dude, that's the part that hits me. He looks up and his son is at the top of the stairs. Like, his, again, it's like a 2-year-old, 3-year-old son.
Do you think that's more metaphoric?
Right. Oh man, to be so broken in front of your child.
Yeah, you can't even, like, get up to them to, like, hold them. It's just this, like, out of reach.
And again, always, he does these optimistic words to him. He just looks at him and he says, it's okay, Robbie. It's okay. And again, you don't see any
Robbie's like, yeah, Dad, it's cool. I'm good.
You don't see any resolution to the scene specifically. It just transitions to the next day where You didn't see him get back up to the top of the stairs. You didn't see him go back to the dinner table. It's almost, I believe that's the next morning when he finally gets the wheelchair, and the wife is like, "Yeah, this is enough.
This is happening.
Like, you're not going downstairs anymore, or you're not going down up and down the stairs anymore. You know, we're putting the bed in the kitchen, and that's that."
And at some point, maybe a little bit earlier, you could have put the house up for sale and got a single story home.
You think so? But I mean, if you look for a lot of different flats in London or anywhere in England.
Did you do the real estate, Drew? Come on. Don't be a dick. Don't just say, oh, you know, Nathan, I...
Okay, if you look for a lot of the different, like, the places that you can live in London, a lot of it's built up. It's not built wide. It's built up. And what I did do, though, researching the housing that they got, since, I mean, they're not rich. Like, Jane doesn't have a job, obviously. She is, like, 100% a personal caregiver. Okay? She has kids to raise. She's still going to school. Stephen, at this point, I think is like having a, he might be like a part-time professor at Cambridge where he was still going to school. But what they did is that the home that they were staying in was for students. It was student housing. So,
okay, makes sense.
Yeah, that's the whole reason why they were that in that specific type of home. So...
I know, like, maybe, like, one other English place, and that's, 221B Baker Street, but that's the limit of my real estate knowledge of England.
I actually visited 221B Baker Street back in 2009. I went to London and visited the house. It's
look at Drew just showing up, everyone. Well done.
That's
pretty beautiful.
Spent Christmas in London. It's rather beautiful.
They roll this roller coaster, though, through their English flat in life, and they have these great times of, you know, life, and then they have these ups and downs. But just overall, do you think that that the addition of Jonathan was, like, the downfall of them?
I don't feel that it was the downfall of them, because it... It's quoted by Jane Wilder saying that eventually it wasn't even the introduction of Jonathan into their lives, because he became a dear, dear family friend to them, and he was always there and helping and basically being like that second father, you know, in the worst kind of way that's almost, again, heartbreaking, because, like, it's kind of like that scene where Stephen comes home and he sees Jonathan playing piano with Robbie and showing up like, I'm doing things for your kids that you probably never, not even probably, you never will be able to do.
Yeah.
He was an important part of their lives, but Jane Wilder was even saying that that wasn't really like the detriment of their marriage. It was the fact that it was the publicity. It was all of the celebrity aspect that came in their lives and the constant flood of in-home doctors and nurses. That essentially, for the longest time, it was her, and she almost became obsolete. So that became like the downfall of the marriage, from what I was researching.
How weird!
It's an interesting story where, when Stephen Hawking actually divorced Jane Wilder and he eventually married Elaine, the new nurse that came to like treat him. He's quoted as saying, "Oh, I have married the woman I love."
Oh,
yeah, kind of heartbreaking. But
shots fired.
Even with her, like, they eventually got divorced. That woman wrote a book. Again, Stephen Hawking didn't read that one either, and he went back to being good friends with Jane Wilde in order to be closer to his kids, because he was being so disconnected from his kids. And this is the stuff that you don't see. They take literally this 30-year span of their marriage. And again, it's not like you would be expected to like not cram it down into a 2-hour movie, obviously, but we're missing such crucial insights of their lives. And it's, again, it's a very safe movie. They're showing only certain parts, and they're showing different aspects that will tug on the heartstrings, make you feel for them. But there's so many different things that are not addressed. Like, we see Stephen Hawking presenting his ideas for, you know, black hole theory. And we certainly see the fact that he publishes his books. But really, the only work that we truly see him do is, again, you know, kind of call back to Beautiful Mind moment, where we see him drawing on a chalkboard. And then we see him delivering his speech to the group of professors saying, you know... So here's a black hole. It's full with, you know, dark radiation energy, and that's why it's, you know, that's why it's a black hole. So the universe is made from a big boom, And the guy
spoken like a true professor, Drew.
Preposterous, and he storms out. That's actually one of the other moments that I didn't necessarily enjoy. Like, two people said, that's preposterous, and they stormed out of the room. And
then the rest of them?
And then everyone else is kind of like, oh, gosh, they said it was bad. Should we say it was bad? Then you have the one guy stand up. Oh, I am from the Soviet Academy. You know, I am from Russia.
Black hole.
in Soviet Russia, black hole, you. What? You have the one guy just say, like, I came here trying to find, like, bad evidence and falsified data, or, like, I think he would bring nothing to table. No. Like, he says, the little man has got it. And of course, like, everyone else is, oh, yay, this is good. The Russian thinks it's great, so it must be.
So, it's approved.
If Russia says it's good, it must be okay. That's what I got from that scene. It was a very awkward scene, honestly. I found it weird, but
wait,
that's just me.
Would this be the... Is this your cut it out?
That's
I know I
kind of
did
out.
My
that's
cut
like
it
my
out,
honorable
but...
mention. I think it's a better cut it out than the whole, you know, walk-in scene at the end of the film. I think it's a better option, but I already made my claim. This is just my, like, highest honorable mention there.
Did you do your cut it out?
I did. Remember, it was the whole scene where they were, at the very end, that he was getting crowned. Or crowned.
Oh, yes,
he
yes,
was
yes,
getting
yes,
knighted
yes, yes,
by
yes.
the queen.
Yes, yes, yes.
It was the slow walking in, and then them, again, not to like befuddle your, you can say that again, I liked the line, but I didn't need that awkward conversation with them at the end.
Do you think that line could have been placed with maybe a little bit faster, I don't want to say a montage, but just like better shots of their life showing, oh, he married Elaine. They divorced. He kind of got back with his family to, like, be close
See,
to them.
This is the whole thing. Like, I don't want to, like, say...
change the movie?
Change the movie for it being back up. Because, honestly, like, at the very end, I think if you added, like, one other line and then it did that whole backtrack, because it did the whole, you know, reverse time and go back. If he did the line... He had his line, look at what we made. And then if you added... like, or even have her, you know, say the line, you know, I would do it again.
Okay.
Or something. I don't know. Something where the effect of going back, because he's going back to, like, the beginning. He's going back to, like, perfect moments for him, which are, I don't know, I think very, very important. But you have this heartfelt moment that is just felt throughout. It's again, it is a very, very... dramatic love story. It is definitely a roller coaster, up and down. You have a man who is incapable of necessarily doing anything himself, I mean, until he actually gets that clicker and he can talk for himself, but other than that, he is solely dependent on someone to take care of him, and he almost he doesn't have a life of his own per se.
Yeah,
because it revolves around those with him. And
what a weird truth, though. You know, like, yeah. It's like you have this whole life, but yet you don't. You require somebody at all times to live.
Right.
So crazy. But Drew, I have a surprise segment that you'll. I'm sure you'll try and think of some really cool, quick little. Thing to roll, so roll it. All right, and this segment, which as you're gonna find out in whatever Drew puts together for that little segment, is called
I have no idea what's happening.
It's called That's a Wrap.
That's
and
a
it's
wrap.
Who would you never ever want to see direct this film?
Oh gosh.
And so for me, it would be Quentin Tarantino.
No, you took it.
I would never want to see Stephen Hawking at the very, very beginning of it say the theory of everything. And
this
then,
was exactly, you said who would never direct this, and I thought immediately, God, Quentin Tarantino would like screw this up so badly.
For the first one, we can pick the same director, that's fine. But
oh,
like, yeah,
man.
This would be such an awkward Quentin Tarantino film of, wait a minute, why are we going back? why is there very weird indie music playing throughout most of this film? Yeah,
that would be, man, that would be so, yeah, I agree. I
think Uma Thurman is Jane.
No, even that. You keep
just director.
Oh my gosh, that would be so weird. That'd be bad. That'd be really, really weird. Man, do you remember back in the day? And by back in the day, I mean not that, you know, long ago. They had the whole ALS ice bucket challenge.
Yes.
God, what? Okay, so again, guys, if you don't know what ALS is, it is Lou Gehrig's disease.
There's a thing called Google.
Yeah, thing called Google. They described it as, you know, the motor neuron disease. You know, eventually your body just, it does not, you know, have control over the muscles and the nerves. And you eventually, you can't swallow, you can't move your arm, you can't do anything. And so what, there was like this huge outcry to suddenly donate to the ALS Foundation and have all of these donations go. And so the ice bucket challenge came to be, you know,
there are a couple of things that future generations will look back on us and be like, wow, what a barbaric society. One of those, SeaWorld. Another thing, Tide Pods.
which Tide made a very big, you know, moment in this film.
Any challenge that was, you know, connected to a YouTube, and the crowning achievement of challenge the Ice Bucket Challenge.
I mean, I get the idea that, like, hey, let's donate to, like, ALS Foundation. That's fantastic. Let's get some, you know, money to a well-worthy cause, because obviously it is. But I never understood the whole idea of, hey, I'm here for the Ice Bucket Challenge. I was nominated by my good friend Stan, and I'm going to do it here. And I'm calling out Mark and Sarah, and if they don't do it, they have to donate $100 to a charity of their choice. And
here's cold water pouring over my head. Here's
cold water over ice.
Oh my gosh, it was so cold. Oh, that was really cold.
Such a fascination. I did it. Over Facebook and YouTube, and it's like, who is really monitoring this honor system of who actually donated and who did not?
No better than when they did hobo fights, and like it'd take two homeless guys, and the winner would get a sandwich. Fights. Like, wait a minute. Yes, I get it. The means don't justify the end. Just because you,
that's a weird connection that you made, like donating to a charity and homeless people fighting.
But that's what it is. Like, you're giving $100
to fads. I get it. I totally get that.
But like, for pure entertainment of ha ha ha, you dumped cold water on your head. Now you opted out of donating to this charity. You jerk. How dare you? but everybody did it. Everybody. Like, there were so many people that,
you know what's crazy? Kinda, I was never nominated, not one time.
I may have gotten called out once or twice, but then you had the opposite where people were like, oh yeah, I'm gonna do it. And then they like pour it out and be like, idiots, I'm gonna donate $100 because that's what you're supposed to do to charities. Like, boom, here's $100.
Right.
And then did they send it?
You give from your heart.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's it. I mean, yeah.
But at the same time, I wonder how much money actually was raised.
I'm curious how much money was actually raised. True. Like, through legitimate reasons. And not just people, like, getting on there and trying to, you know, get likes on their Instagram or get more views on their YouTube channel. Man, you know what? If a genuine amount of money was actually donated, that's probably something I should have looked up. But if a genuine amount of money was actually donated, that's great. I think that's fantastic.
It was worth it.
I think the only other benefit that came from this is that there's quite a few little snippets of videos, especially on Vines, where people try to be clever. Like, they filled a bulldozer, like the front end of a bulldozer, with water, and they tried to like tip it to dump it on some guy, but it ended up just smacking him in the head and knocking him out.
Oh, wow.
I mean, there's funny little videos like that, but yeah. You know, There's many, many different movies out there that can actually portray, obviously, debilitating illnesses and, you know, life-altering conditions that can be seen out there, you know, Hulu on Amazon or Netflix and anything like that. One movie that actually, if anyone else is wanting to watch or even learn more about ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, there's a fantastic film. If you have Amazon Prime or if you want to go out and find it, it's called You're Not You. And this is a fantastic movie with Hilary Swank about a very prominent lady who plays piano, and she's married to a well-to-do kind of lawyerish gentleman, and it just chronicles her life and her marriage with this guy, but more importantly, with the caregiver who comes to take care of her. And through their relationship, Hilary Swank's character ends up giving this kind of like college dropout, doesn't take anything in life seriously girl this idea that life should be taken seriously and cherished. And she gives her like a new lease on life. She gives her something to be proud of. And that's taking care of Hilary Swank. It's a beautifully tragic movie. I tell you right now, grab the tissues. You will need
spoiler alert tissues.
But it's a great film. It's a really, really good film.
It's hard not. I mean, like, I think that there's a lot of films that kind of delve into that, terminal, you know, this is not going to end well. And there's some that I kind of think that are a little bit cheap with it. You know, my view on A Walk to Remember and A Fault in Our Stars, which is basically just someone going, oh my gosh, remember that movie, A Walk to Remember? What if both of the kids had terminal illnesses and, like, why? Who writes this stuff? But at the same time, this can be life, and this it makes for good writing because it definitely is a tearjerker. But
right there, man, there are those moments in life where definitely you are going to have your emotional struggle and strife. And again, the wrong way to put it, but if Hollywood can make a buck off it, they will. But more importantly, it's telling a story. You have these different movies that are definitely telling a story. Kind of like, so take the movie Philadelphia with, you know, Denzel Washington and Tom Hanks. I mean, I don't think you actually have like a more honest story about someone with AIDS, I think, done in Hollywood.
Yeah, that really sealed the deal on I think the need for an AIDS film that described the prejudice and the harsh reality of it,
right,
to a T.
Yeah, it's just one of those things where tugging on the heartstrings of the audience is going to be a hell of a lot more beneficial than making them laugh. You can make them laugh. There can be some funny moments. Heck, even The Theory of Everything had some pretty funny moments in some instances.
It did.
But it's drawing you to those characters and making you connect with them. It's making you feel with them. And that's exactly what we had with Eddie Redmayne portraying Stephen Hawking and Felicity Jones as Jane Wilder.
And that, you know, is what it's all about.
I think so.
Drew, is there anything in the mailbag for us this week?
You know, we didn't have anything in the mailbag this week. And we didn't have anything there. I did. You know what? It's not really like a great moment to like complain about something, but I was checking our reviews and ooh. I don't know who it is. I don't know who you are, but I will find you. And I will hunt you down. Not really.
But good luck.
Someone left us one star.
Aw.
And I'm hoping it was like an accidental thumb slip. But someone left one star. It made me very sad. I did, and no review, just a star. So I don't really know how to take it. But you know what? We have enough people out there that have been showing a lot of love. And have been definitely driving in the downloads and, you know, giving us some high praise for what we're doing. So, you know what? We got some good people.
Oh, yeah, we do.
We got some good people on our side.
And if we got some 5-star reviews, we should we'll be reading them on the line, on the air. And I like the mailbag. I like when people write in some questions.
I also like the mailbag. People need to like, guys, if you ever want to give us any kind of like insight to how we're doing or what you like, maybe even what you don't like, because you know what? We want to give you a good quality program. But more importantly, yeah, if you want to know more about us, if you want to know more about Drew, if you want to know more about Nathan, if you want to know more about like the show itself and our process, like what our histories are, or our likes and our dislikes, hey, you hit us up on Twitter, you know, at RealFeelsPod, or you can send us an email at RealFeelsPodcast@gmail.com. Just send on over them questions. We are
send some love.
More than happy to get on there and answer those questions. I think it would be, as I am very prone to say, a hoot and a half.
A hoot nanny.
A hoot nanny. So, yeah.
That'll do it for us, everyone.
Yeah. But you know what, guys? Make sure that you subscribe on iTunes and Podbean. And as we said, wouldn't hurt to jump on there. Give us a nice review. 5 stars.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
5. And you know what? Tell your friends. We're here every other Wednesday.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth. You know, shout it from the rooftops. Send carrier pigeons. Possibly rent a plane and fly it across the sky. You know, anything.
I want a picture of that. I want to see that. That's awesome.
That'd be great. Someone do it. We would love to have it. So, guys, you know, coming in the next couple of weeks, we're going to be having an action movie for you, a special treat that will go out to our good friend Wayne at the Countdown Podcast, who is currently recovering from a hip replacement surgery.
A good well, get well soon film.
Yeah, this is definitely going to be right up his alley and something that I personally think that he will definitely enjoy. And yeah, so we got that coming out. And after that, it'll actually be it'll be my birthday, Nathan. It'll be my birthday podcast. So that'll be coming up on May 9th.
And you're going to pick the movie for that week.
You know what? I will. I will pick that movie.
It's all you.
We'll have that. And then on the 23rd of May, guys, we're going to have a very, very special episode. It's going to be a fantasy movie. Our very first fantasy movie, but more importantly, we are going to have our very first guest on the episode, and it's going to be our good friend Jack.
Oh, Jack. Oh, Mr. Jack.
It's going to be a lot of fun. And you know what? We want you here with us. So again, every other Wednesday on iTunes and Podbean. And we'll catch you on the flip side, guys.
Can't wait to see you there.
Hey, you're the realest, Nathan.
The feelest.
Yeah.